And actually, I've kind of prayed for you. I'll pray for you again. Father, thank you for Seb, and thank you for the word that you've given him to bring to us this morning. We pray that you would give us ears to hear and hearts to respond in obedience and faith. Amen.
Great. Good morning, everyone. Is there a weird echo going on, or is that just me? It's a train, is it? Oh, okay. Sorry. Still a newbie to Gloucester. Okay. Not used to that in rural Devon. Good to see you all. And we're going to pick up today, if you have your Bibles, in Luke 20. We're going to pick up in verse 45. And last week, we were just kind of coming towards the end of Jesus' conversation with the religious leaders, I should say. And he asks them a question. They've been quizzing him. They've been trying to catch him out. And then he comes back with a question. And he posits the question in such a way that is relevant for the leaders of the time. And essentially the question is this. Do you think I am just a son, or do you think I could be really divine? And he says, you know, because David says that the Son of God will come from my line, but he's also in heaven. And for a Jewish man of the time, it would be just incomprehensible that they would worship a son. And so the leaders of the time, they were expecting Messiah, but they did not think he would be divine. And Jesus says, but what do you think I am? Do you think I am just a son? Do you think I am just a human? Or do you think I'm really divine? And we were looking at that. And really in the center of that question, in Jesus' final plea, his final extension of salvation, the question is, who do you think I am? Who do you say that I am? And how we ask that question today in the culture that we live in this post-truth culture. And we were looking a little bit at what post-truth is. But here's the major point. We have something, an incredible opportunity to do something countercultural in this post-truth culture we live in, not simply because we believe something to be true, not simply because we think we have something of the truth, but actually because we follow somebody who says he is the truth. And Jesus, in saying he is the truth, proves that he is true, because truth has to manifest itself into reality. If truth doesn't become real, it's not true. But Jesus proves that he's true in the foundations of the earth. He is the word that is truth. He proves that he is true when he comes in the flesh, the incarnation, the carne, literally meaning meat. He shows up in the flesh and he says, I testify to the truth. And in doing so, he endorses the Old Testament and he commissions and prepares the way for the New Testament. And here's the thing. Walt Disney says, observe the masses and do the opposite. And often the church has done the opposite, which is to do the same. Often we've observed the masses, we've observed the culture, and we've shifted the goalposts in such a way, or even worse, we've shifted the deck chairs just to keep the ship afloat, just to try and fit in. But actually, in the time where people are saying, what is truth? Is there even such a thing as truth? We can have supreme confidence that we have the word that is true, that is centered around the truth, Jesus Christ. I heard it said that the question of whether this is true is not an important question. I want to say this, it's one of the most important questions. In the time we live in, it is one of the most important questions. It is of supreme importance that we are confident in the word that we hold. Because to say, well, it could be true and some of it might not be true and some of it may just be good philosophy, is simply allowing the spirit of the age to infringe upon us as God's people. It is not observing the masses and doing the opposite. The church was always a countercultural movement. Always a countercultural movement. And we have an opportunity today to continue to be just that. Anyway, that was just a little recap from last week. We're going to carry on. And this really transitions from Jesus' question now and the closure, really, of his conversation with the leaders, the religious rulers of the time. And now he's focusing back on his disciples. And he says this in verse 45. And in the hearing of all the people, he said to his disciples, beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love greetings in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense they make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. And Jesus looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the offering box. And he saw a poor widow put in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all of them. For they all contributed out of the abundance, but she, out of her poverty, put in all that she had to live on." Here's the thing, it transitions from a question to a warning. But in order for us to understand the warning, it's helpful for us to understand who these scribes were and why Jesus is giving the warning in the first place. The scribes were really the kind of lawyers of Israel. They were considered to be held in very, very high esteem. Every scribe was a Pharisee, not every Pharisee was a scribe. They were arguably one of the most, if not the most, dominant force throughout Israel because they dealt in matters of spirituality in that they translated the law and showed people how to live out the law, but they also dealt in matters of practicality when it came to housing and ownership and wealth and land and all those things. And so when they dealt with these things and when they said things and when they wrote things and when they declared things, they were considered to be sacred. They were held in such high esteem that whatever the scribes did was considered to be sacred. They were literally considered to be the agents of God, but they were also hypocrites. And there's loads and loads of conflicting kind of commentaries around just what the scribes were up to. But what we see from Jesus is that they were clearly taking advantage of a very vulnerable group within the society of the time, widows. And it might have been that they were using their legality and their legal minds to sign over wealth and housing to them. Or perhaps they were getting the widows in such a place that they would have to loan them money at extortionate interest rates. And then when the widows couldn't repay, they would go into the houses and literally, as Jesus says, devour the houses, taking everything. It may have been that they even abused their position of authority, that they abused that in such a way that was physical. But they were hypocrites. And despite their legal brilliance and their intellectual brilliance, they desired something of notability. They wanted to be seen in the best places. They wanted to be seated in the best seats. They wanted to be hanging out with the influencers of the time. They wanted to be seen to be really, really somebody. And so the essence of the scribes is this. It was pride. You see, when Jesus is giving the warning to the disciples, he's not warning them about behavior. He knows that the disciples are not going to engage in that behavior. And he knows that the disciples don't even need to worry about the actual behavior of the scribes. They're not widows themselves. But what he's getting at is the actual essence of the scribes, which was pride. They were selfish. They were hypocritical. They were self-absorbed. They were proud. And so the warning for us today, as Jesus' disciples, is that of pride. Is that of pride. What is pride? Pride is really the obsession with self. The obsession of me. My self-worth, my self-esteem, my place. My obsession with my rights, what I am entitled to. It's all about me. But it can also be about other people. It can manifest in such a way that we compare ourselves downwards. So we may look at others, and in our pride, we may look at them and say, you know, we're doing pretty good. Like, we've got this, and we've acquired that, and we own this, and I've achieved this, and our family looks like this. We're doing pretty well, and that can be pride manifesting itself. Pride can also compare ourselves upwards. And we can look at other people, and because we feel such a sense of entitlement, we think we should have that. And so when they get this, or when they achieve this, or when they own this, we should have that. That's what we deserve. I should get that. And so that is, in itself can be a manifestation of pride, and it leads to a critical spirit. We want to undermine other people that do well, because actually, in the side, we really want it for ourselves. Pride is the obsession of self, and we can reflect and compare downwards, and we can reflect and compare upwards as well. Humility is one of those words that's difficult to define, but for the Christian, it's easy to juxtaposition it with pride. And so if pride is the obsession of self, humility has to be the obsession with Jesus. As we're obsessed with Jesus, so our selfishness diminishes, and so our selflessness rises, and so we are more humble and we are more giving and generous to those around us. But it has to be the obsession with Jesus. Instead of comparing ourselves downwards to people, we compare ourselves to Jesus and we realize just how holy he is and how much we need him. Instead of comparing ourselves upwards to people and thinking we should have that and we should get this and we should own this, we compare ourselves to Jesus and realize actually we've been given everything as our inheritance through him. Pride is the obsession with self. humility is obsession of him. But the problem is, in our culture, humility is not really a virtue that is chased after. There was a book that was written in 1991 called The Book of Virtues. And this was really a compilation of Western thoughts, Western philosophy, even included some C.S. Lewis in there. Some kind of religion, some Eastern religion, was all kind of compiled into this kind of westernized book, and it became a New York Times bestseller. It was written by a chap who was an advisor to, firstly, Reagan and then Bush Sr. And this book became really almost a cornerstone, particularly in the States, for how we should instill morality into young people and into children, and a huge, huge book, a tome of a book. And so the idea is that we'd read this to our kids and somehow this would enable us to raise decent human beings. But the one virtue that does not appear on any page is that of humility. It's just not there. Because in our culture, humility kind of looks like compromise. In our culture, humility kind of looks like weakness. It looks like taking a step back. It looks like giving in. It looks like giving an inch. Humility looks like coming second place. Humility may even look like you take a back seat. Humility, God forbid, may even look like you are completely anonymous. And our culture says, no, no, no. You need to be noticed. You need to step up. You need to get what's coming to you. Don't give in. Take the inch. Take the mile. Don't compromise. Stand your ground. Humility is not an attribute or virtue that we particularly chase after. And if you don't believe that, turn on your TVs. I defy you to find the latest rap artist give an interview and talk about humility. I defy you to find the latest footballer who's earning £300,000 a week to talk about humility. Even our MPs who may give the pretense of humility by sitting on train floors and all that kind of stuff. I really think that when you peel back the layers, we just don't find humility. We just don't see it. It is a virtue that is looked down upon. And that's where we are culturally. And shockingly and worryingly, and I'll say this, and it is just an opinion, that just as the culture looks down upon humility, actually, increasingly, I believe, particularly in the westernized church, it is becoming increasingly looked down upon. I was at a conference, and I will say it wasn't Focus, so I just want to get that in there. But I was at a conference over the summer, and I wanted to check out the bookstore. So I went into the bookstore, and there was just a whole shelf of books about me. It was amazing. Seb, know your destiny. Seb, know your blessing. Seb, get your best life now. Literally, the title of a bestseller written by one of the best-selling authors in America, Your Best Life Now. All about you. You get what's coming to you. All these selfisms that are creeping into the church. You know what I really want to do? I really wanted to scoop up those books. I wanted to get in the DeLorean. I wanted to get a flux capacitor. I realize 80% of the audience don't know what the heck I'm talking about right now. But I wanted to get a flux capacitor. I wanted to get in that car, scoop up all these books, and I wanted to drive back to 2,000 years ago and the emergence of the early church and dump these books about self and self-worth in front of them all and just see what the reaction would be. You know, when the apostles are out on the edge, living out on the edge, giving everything they have to the point of death, how would they feel about your best life now? We have to ensure that the spirit of the age does not infringe on the culture of God's kingdom. We have to ensure it does not infringe upon the culture of God's kingdom. I'll say as well that I want to make just two really kind of main points about the text. But, you know, God deals with humility. God deals with pride. And brings about humility in a varying kind of ways. For some, these people are quite annoying. For some, it's like you can see them going off track and God appears to them in a dream. And they'll say to you, you know, God spoke to me last night and he tenderly kind of came around me and he just kind of set me on the right path. And off they go on the right path. And for others, it's like they have this kind of Damascus Road kind of experience where God literally shows up in his tangible presence and kind of almost breaks the person to see their stinking pride and to bring forward their glorious humility. Or for some, it's that they have to kind of get to rock bottom. They really have to kind of get to the lowest of places for God to reveal their pride and to bring forth their humility. And for some, it is the ministry of embarrassment. It is the ministry of embarrassment, and I am the recipient of the ministry of embarrassment. A few years ago, I was in my early 20s, and I was asked to speak at a youth event. And also to do some hosting. And so I went to this planning meeting, and they brought out the agenda, and I could see what I was doing. And on the night I was hosting, I looked along the list, and my heart nearly leapt out of my chest because there was a minor Christian celebrity coming to speak that night. Now, I have to tell you, I find the whole concept of Christian celebrity repugnant, and I believe God does as well. But at that time, and at that age, when I was young and impressionable, I couldn't believe it. I thought they'd made a mistake. I thought they'd put me in the wrong slot, so I just kept quiet. And in the weeks and months leading up to this evening, I was like kind of just casually dropping it into conversation, and, you know, I'm going to be hosting the night when this person's going to come and speak. And honestly, I was kind of obsessed with this guy. I knew every book. I had every book. I still have every book. I can quote large portions of his sermons. You know, he was a real kind of rock star Christian speaking to thousands of people. And the more and more and closer we got to the evening, so I would just kind of do the sweet, humble brag, you know? It's like, well, I'm just going to be humble about it. God's kind of raised up this opportunity. But what I really want you to know is that I'm bragging and I'm actually really proud of myself that I get to share this platform. Ugh, what a load of rubbish. Share this platform with this minor Christian celebrity. And in the week leading up to it, I brought a new shirt. I just about managed to do the buttons up. I brought it in next, not the most forgiving place for big guys like me. Anyway, so got this shirt, squeezed into it, didn't eat for 2 days, not because I was fasting, but anyway, so brought this shirt and had my hair cut. I thought I need to have a slightly more cooler haircut that says that I'm not from rural Mid-Devon. So I got my hair cut, and then it got to the night of the event, and all I could think about was me and this minor Christian celeb and how I was going to greet him and how I was going to pray for him and how we would maybe hang out and do a debrief at the end and how we would do ministry time together and the little relationship on stage. And sorry. So it gets to an hour. Okay, me and Isla aren't married at the time, but she's with me, and I'm living with my mum and dad, and I think, oh, my hair doesn't quite look like it did when they did it in the barbershop. So I'm rooting through my mum and dad's cupboards for any hair product I could possibly find. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's amazing what falls out. Like these big gold canisters of hairspray, like this, unbelievable. I'm sure they're fire hazards. But anyway, so I'm like rooting through, and that doesn't look right. And then I found a fair trade pot of hair gel. Now, fair trade, back then, is not the fair trade it is now. They used to make some ropey products, and I'm going to write a letter of complaint. So anyway, I slap this stuff on. I'm looking, okay, I'm good to go. Shirt on, in the car, off we go. Literally, in the car, I said to Isla, it smells like I've got a dead cow in the back. And the thing is, because of where we lived, that wasn't an unusual smell, but it was really, really strong. And so we got to the event, and I'm waiting for this minor Christian celeb to show up, and I'm hanging around at the side. He doesn't get there until literally 2 minutes before he's about to speak. What a git. Anyway, so, but as I'm waiting there, I'm thinking, oh, this smell is horrible. Maybe it's like the meat processing factory, or maybe it's a farm, maybe it's the time of year. I don't know, but this smell is really, really strong. So this minor Christian celeb comes up, and I put my arm around him to pray, and he's a bit kind of cold, backing off, and then he kind of shuts me down really quickly. Then at the end of the meeting, I said, oh, should we do the ministry time together? No, he was fine. He wanted to do that on his own. Then when that finished, I went up to chat to him, and he was really, really kind of like, just didn't want to speak, did not want to engage, but he would speak to other people. And I was really, really offended, really upset. And when I got home, I was like, that minor Christian celeb, he ain't all that. But the smell was still with me. And as I opened the cupboard, I thought, oh, there's the gel that I used. And I looked in it, and I never knew this, but hair products have a sell-by date. And the sell-by date had passed 2 long years ago. And I opened up this thing and squeezed it out. Honestly, I nearly fainted. It was so strong and repugnant. And in that moment, I thought, oh no, what did the minor Christian celeb think about me? And God said, and that's just the point. You made this whole evening about yourself, you absolute moron. You moron. You made it about you. You made it about this person. You missed the point. You know, one of the most scary scriptures to me is in Luke 1:51. It's the Song of Mary. And it says this, that God scatters the proud to the thoughts of their heart. A better translation is that God scatters the proud to the imaginations of their hearts. You know, that night, I built up this whole kind of false reality, and I'd been left to wander in it, left to wander around it. My pride had allowed me to pursue this false reality. And so often I see this in my own life and I see it in the lives of others, that our pride gets in a way to such a degree that actually we lose a sense of reality. We lose a sense of self-awareness, particularly in the areas of conflict, where conflict has reigned for a long time. Pride gets in the way and it gives us a false filter of reality. And so we receive things wrong. We hear things wrong. We process things wrong. And pride often can come as a result of pain. And so where there's broken relationships, we may feel that actually the reason we can't engage is because of our pain. But on top of the pain, there's an altar to pride. And it's leading to a false, distorted reality. We're left to wander around in the imaginations of our hearts. I was left to wander around in the imagination of my heart on that particular evening with dire and embarrassing consequences. God will deal with it one way or another. Don't let it be through the ministry of embarrassment. I want to say just two things to finish, and we'll try and zip through fairly quickly. The first thing is this, that pride inhibits our ability to love. Pride inhibits our ability to love. If I said to you what would you say is the most defining characteristic of God? Love. Put your hand up if you would say love. Okay, we'd all be on the same page. John says God is love, and it's like his whole nature and character is that of love. If we could somehow behold the spectrum of his character and nature, it would be love. Interestingly, the most written about attribute of God is his holiness. More than 600 times it is written about his holiness. But I have to say, one of the most ringing and clear attributes of God has to be his humility. And humility and love are inextricably linked. Paul says in that famous passage in 1 Corinthians 13, that love does not seek its own. And so if humility is about anyone but us, and if love does not seek its own, it means that humility has to be the essence of love. And so the pursuit of humility and the killing of our pride allows us to love better. It allows us to love more effectively. On Thursday, we looked at a passage in John 13. We don't have to turn to it just now. And I'm sorry if you came on Thursday and you're going to hear a little bit of a repeat of what I said then. But it just gripped me in such a way. Honestly, I thought my heart was going to burst into 1,000 pieces. At the beginning of that scripture, Jesus is entering into the night of his arrest. And John says that he knew what was about to happen. He knew that his hour had come. And so he knows what is about to unfold. But there's this wonderful, wonderful line at the beginning of John 13 that says this. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them until the end. He's with his disciples. He knows what is about to happen. And John says he loved them until the end. You know what I find amazing about that is that because he knew that the hour was upon him, he knew that he was about to be arrested. He knew that he was about to be mocked. He knew that he was about to be tortured. He knew that they were literally about to put him on his knees and that they were going to flog him to within an inch of his life. Many people did not survive the flogging. He knew that his flesh would be torn open, that his bones would be exposed, and that organs would be possibly flung out. He knew that they would put a fake robe upon him, and that robe would stick to his back, and it would soak up the blood, and that they would drive this crown of thorns upon his head. He knew that they'd beat him. He knew that they would move him around the courtyard like a pawn on a chessboard. They would cast lots, and depending where he landed, depending on the paving slab that he would fall upon, there would be another form of humiliation coming his way. He knew that he'd be laughed at. He knew that they would rip that robe off his back. He knew that he would have to carry a beam weighing 9-10 stone. He knew that he wouldn't be able to make it. He knew that he would be pinned to the cross and raised up for people to spit and to mock. And in that moment, he loves them until the end. In that moment, he's not focused on himself. If ever there was a time that somebody may be focused, if ever there was a time that they would want their feet washed or to be worshipped, to be adored and acknowledged, surely it was now. But he loved them until the end. That's amazing. But you know what really grips me? Is not only did he know what was about to happen, he knew why. He knew why. It was because of sin that he was about to endure the things that he was about to endure. And Jesus has a front row seat to sin, most notably with his disciples in the past 3 years. He's living with them, he's traveling with them, he's eating with them. He would see the brokenness of sin, the brokenness of humanity. He would have seen the selfishness. He would have seen the pride, the ego, the arrogance, the anger. And as he builds up to that time, he knows this stuff, this brokenness, this muck, that's why I'm going to endure what I'm about to endure. You see, Jesus didn't just take the sin. He isn't just our propitiation, our scapegoat. He is our substitute. And being our substitute, he becomes the very worst of humanity. He became the very worst of what he witnessed in the 3 years with these sinful men that he was surrounded by. And in that moment, he loves them until the end. Humility and love, they're inextricably linked. When Jesus came, which palace was he born to? Which influential family was he born in with wealth and magnificence? Which group of wonderfully raised disciples did he pick at the hands of the best rabbis? Which powerful worldwide ministry did he lead with the best travel, the best hotels, the best food? Which influential people did he want to sit with, be seen with, hang out with? Which of the best places did he want to be seen in? Where were the places that he went where he knew that he would get acclaim and praise and wonder? When was the time that he welcomed all the followers? When was the time that he tried to big up crowds, to try to pull in crowds? Where was the magnificent, regal incarnation with the trumpets and the horse and the golden crown? Where was the magnificent, splendorous death? Where was the magnificent tomb, the wonderful funeral with all the trimmings? It's just not there. He is love, but humility is the essence of love. And folks, even on the cross, he is acting in humility. He looks to John and he says, "Behold your mother. Take care of her, look after her." He looks to the thief to his side, and even as the pain and the weight of sin is bearing down on him, he extends his arm just for one more person who could come into the kingdom. It's humility and love. Humility and love. And folks, if we struggle to love, if we struggle to love people or a person, a friend, a family member, a colleague, even an enemy, a great place to start is to check our own hearts for humility, to check our own hearts for places of pride, where we've built altars of pride, to stop looking at them as the problem and maybe to consider that perhaps it's us. Perhaps it's us. That's what Jesus models for us. Humility is the essence of love. And I'll finish with this. When Jesus is giving this warning, and I kind of love the scene because I can see that he's now gathering in his disciples and his people maybe just trying to overhear what he's saying about these scribes. And it says this, that Jesus looked up and he sees the widow. And if you can kind of picture the scene, it's probably busy. There's people coming and bringing their offerings. And I reckon if we had CCTV back in those days and there was some kind of incident and we saw this widow and we wanted to find out who she was and we went to the traders or the religious leaders and we said, did you notice this widow that we could see? Does anybody know who she is? I bet nobody would have even noticed her. I bet nobody would have even seen her. You see, what she did looked really insignificant. It looked really small. It looked non-impressive. But Jesus looks up and he spies her doing what she's doing. And in some translations in the Message, it says that she literally gave her all. In other translations, Jesus says, this is the greater gift. And I want to say this, that humility allows us to all manifest the greatest gift. All of us have the greater gift. All of us have the ability to give our all when we allow humility to come forth. It may not look much. It may not be impressive. And in the age of rock star minor Christian celebrities, perhaps even in this room, we may think, well, that doesn't account for much. You see, sometimes we make the things that seem impressive, the goal or the touchdown or the hat trick. Or what do you do in rugby when you get it over the line? A try. That's the one. We make that the try. So, oh, this person, they're a published author. They've reached it. They've got the try. This person speaks to people all over the world. They fly in airplanes to conferences. That's the try. That's the touchdown. They've released a best-selling album. That's the try. That's the touchdown. They're a great blogger, a great thinker. They have 100,000 followers across multiple social media accounts. That must be the try. That must be the touchdown. That must be the presence, the anointing, the manifest proof that this person is really gifted. And we make that impressive. Now, hear me, please. Jesus actually doesn't condemn the other gift. He doesn't look at the bigger gifts and condemn those. And we need the bigger gifts. But the hope for all of us is that if it doesn't look like that for you and it doesn't look like that for me, we all have the greater gift within us. We all have the greater gift to give. We all have something to give that comes from us, to give our all, to give something of our essence when humility reigns. I was talking to somebody in this church this week and they're involved in a ministry and they said, you know what, I feel really insignificant when I do this ministry. I said, oh, why is that? And he said, well, this person I do it with, they're so theologically sharp and they pray amazing prayers and they're really prophetic and shit. And all I really know how to do is just give hugs and love them. And I was like, that's amazing because it comes from you. It's costly. It's the greater gift. You're giving something of yourself, something of your essence. Jean Vanier, who some of you would have heard of, this Canadian Catholic philosopher and theologian, who started the, I think this is the right pronunciation, I'm going to look at Andy, the L'Arche community. Is that the right pronunciation? L'Arche? Yeah. And the way that he started it was he was concerned about the plight of those who had significant developmental disabilities being institutionalized. And so Jean Vanier opened up his home to two guests, two members of one of the local institutions. He wanted them to come and live with him. And the overriding principle, one of the overriding principles, is that he believed that these people actually could teach him something. That they had something to give, that he could learn from them. And from there, this community grew, where they showed love and compassion, where they moved away from the model of institutionalism. And now the L'Arche community exists in over 37 countries, loving tenderly, loving compassionately these people, believing that they can teach other people something, that they have something to offer. Jean Vanier, he gave something of himself. Yes, he was a published writer at that stage. Yes, he was a theologian, but he gave something of his essence. He gave something of his all. Finally, I'll tell you just about a friend of mine and called Andrew. And I've known Andrew for about 10 years, and he's a bit older than me. He's in his late 40s. I met Andrew when he was on the fringes of church, and I really wanted to get involved in youth work because it felt like a good way to rope him in. So anyway, I got Andrew to come and be involved in youth work. And what I always noticed about Andrew, he was the most ordinary bloke I've ever met. Just really ordinary. Ordinary haircut, ordinary looking, ordinarily dressed. Worked really, really hard. Worked 60 hours a week in a night shift kind of job to provide for his family. And he had two children. And I noticed that his family were always really, really happy. His family always had what they needed. They were always given things that they needed. They were always well-dressed, and they went to great places. And that was mainly because Andrew worked like an absolute beast. I also noticed that Andrew would never really buy like the good stuff for him. That often he would turn up and it would be stuff that he would get in charity shops. And he always drove like the beat up car, and his wife drove the really, really nice car. And there was something about that I was drawn to. And after a few years, and this wasn't a secret, it isn't a great secret, it came up in a coffee that his eldest daughter, Sophie, wasn't actually Andrew's daughter. That Andrew met his wife Sue when she was pregnant. She had a one-night stand, and the guy couldn't cope with it, and he fled. Never had anything to do with the family whatsoever. But Andrew met Sue, and he made a decision that he was going to be a dad and a husband to Sue and to this family. And you know what amazed me is I never, ever got a hint that Sophie wasn't Andrew's kid. Because she loved him, and she called him dad, and he loved her, and he'd hug her, and he'd kiss her, and he'd wrap her up. And here's the thing, the culture would look at that and say, that's pretty non-impressive. And I think it is the greater gift. It is beautiful. It's the kingdom manifest. It's restoration. It's the Father's love. It's the Father's heart. It was something of himself, something of his essence. And we all have that within us. Amen.